Let's get started. As promised, here in the end of our chapter, we're not covering much ground in the Gemara itself. We're only doing little bits at a time so that we can make our siyum come a couple weeks from now.
This was last week.
That was last week's?
Yes, I saved it for whoever wanted it.
Okay. Okay. So we're inside a Mishnah is how I'll begin by getting us back around the current teaching we're investigating from the Mishnah. That is the Mishnah on 122a1, where we have three cases regarding non-Jews. A Gentile lights a lamp. Question is, can a Jew benefit from that lamp's light on Shabbat? If he lit the lamp for the Jewish person, the Jew should not benefit. If he lit it for himself, then fine. The reasoning we heard last week in the Gemara in the Talmud was as follows. Ner le'achad, ner le'me'ah. I light one lamp, I have enough light for me, that light gives off luminescence that I can now take advantage of. If I'm a Jewish person, he didn't light it for me. Same thing about watering as animals. If I knew even that the person drew water for his own animals and that his kavanah, his intentionality, was about doing it for his own animals, I could go and benefit from that water immediately, even though it says milachar, after. We didn't say that after had to mean after his animals are done. I just had to understand his mindset. And we remarked about that scenario that seemed to indicate some level of familiarity with the process of how this person watered his animals, and also the understanding that a non-Jewish person who was looking out at other animals for whom he's having compassion would get more water for the watering trough or the hole and not necessarily do it for you. And that mindset and that mindfulness makes a difference. What's that? Was there a...
No.
Well, that's what the question of the Rishonim really was. Or there were several questions. Can I imagine a scenario if I'm a owner of a flock where my animals are out in the sunlight all day? Someone's drawing water from a well. And that person goes and gets enough water so that all the animals hanging out in this little courtyard would have enough to drink. Can I imagine that? I can imagine it. So the rabbis, and the Rishonim particularly, who have opined on the matter, say, I can see that.
You're usually the one who runs. I'm sitting here.
It's your job. It's your job.
You should see even more clearly now.
On that matter of mindset, I was doing a little bit of research about the world of the ancient water trough. And I was just going back through some of the pieces. So There were several types, it turns out. There was one that was a receptacle at the end of what looked like a small aqueduct. There were some that were just a kind of container. I mean, when you imagine such a watering spot for animals, what do you imagine?
Shock.
A what?
Shock. It's a little, it's like an open pipe, long, and water comes in, and any animal that wants to come just goes in.
So you think in the ancient world, you think that of the same
like,
thing?
Like an open tunnel above ground.
Right. I mean, that's the easier way to picture what this is. And is that it's this wooden box, like in the Old West or in the farm, but really, it was some type of ditch or running aqueduct. Why? Why would it be that way? You had too many animals to get to this one little spot. And if it was a place that was set up in the right way, with enough space, then I had absolutely no issue, like we were all thinking that we should let the guy's animals go first. It really was no issue if it was one of these designs where enough animals could approach the, for lack of a better term, canal system. If it was only one box, or if it was only one spot where water's spouting out, that would be a very difficult scenario for a single group of animals, let alone a good part of a flock. So just by way of picturing this in our minds again, important that we have a conception of ancient technology or the classical world's technology.
I just have a quick question, without laboring point, but because I can't picture this entire setup. Are we talking about a cup there and people have animals? Are we talking about something that's happening out in the
well, first
field?
Of,
we're not anywhere near.
Right, so,
okay.
Wait. First of all, we're talking about it being in a Tichum Shabbat. That's the first and foremost, most important point. That could still be. Maybe we don't know. It didn't say in a chatzer. It didn't say in a sadeh. And when the Mishnah doesn't represent a certain case in a certain spot, then those variables, mitigating factors, a la voah, they're not really of our concern until what?
Until they are.
Until they are. Or until someone imagines them in a response that they are providing in an assessment of what the case is trying to teach specifically. And that's why when we study Mishnah, qua Mishnah, without any Gemara a lot of the time, we can challenge ourselves in Chevruta and say, what do you think the case is right here? And that's not the blind leading the blind. It's true that we could be informed by Rashi in the way we read text, or in the case of the Mishnah, the Bartonura, the Italian commentator, 15th century, who reads the Gemara ahead and indicates what the Gemara is oftentimes saying, which is what Kahati's project was, the 20th century banker in Israel, who wrote the Mishnah, whose translation and commentary we looked at when I was talking about Rabban Gamliel, who will be in the third case in our Mishnah. But we have to really give ourselves over to the what ifs, or the how now. What really is the scenario here? Where does it seem to make the most sense? In a place where non-Jews and Jews would meet one another. Where would that place be? In some of the more populated area of the city or of the settlement, out as opposed to out in the field. Unless we're all grazing our animals, we know they have to eat on Shabbos, we know there's a specific way that Jewish animals eat on Shabbos, some of the grains and grasses that I put aside, so they can't go out and just pluck up any random grass. if I'm a Jewish shepherd or I'm a Jewish flock owner. So it's even more likely that it's in an area where we have our animals and they're not going to transgress a major category of Sabbath law. Is that right inside my chatzer, or is it right outside our living quarters? Some people suggested that those places where we kept the grasses and we kept the feed and we kept those kinds of things were kind of right outside. And that was a somewhat of a common area for those who lived in this settlement, Jews and non-Jews alike, who might have had their areas where their animals' feed was stored and kept, and that we would meet one another there. We would meet at the watering hole still, much like the ancient mode of meeting at the well. Lahavdil, now you had a little bit more of a technological breakthrough and places to both store your feed and put your water. So, just by way of an interesting picture of life unfolding as we read the Mishnah. So we have the two cases. Those were the first two in our Mishnah that we're calling our Mishnah. Third case, Rabban Gamliel. And last week we read through Gemara just to make a little chazara, a little review, that we saw some of the explanation that this candlelight was ner lemea, as I mentioned. It's enough light for one, it's enough light for 100, and the argument whether or not that principle was the principle that Rabban Gamliel's case allowed us to understand, and that is the application of the gangplank is for everyone, therefore if I disembark, I'm just fine. And he didn't really do it for me. Was he in my presence or was he not in my presence? And did he know that I was on the ship and did he not know that I was on the ship? And this got us to the larger issue of Gentiles and the Sabbath, again and again. One small part of the Gemara, before we launch into what I said this week will be an investigation somewhat off the page and into other sources and into Talmudic passages regarding Gentiles and the Sabbath. So I'm on 122a3, left-hand column. Tashima, come and hear. So if we have a Tashima in the Gemara, that's going to ultimately introduce a limud from which we might discern something new and novel about what we just said before. Or it's going to be an application of a principle or a way of understanding that we've learned in the Gemara before. And more rare, as we see, Tashima can mean, what do we do with this case? Now we ought to consider this. Come here, a refutation from a Mishnah, though. Ir she Yisrael v'nochrim darin betocha. Regarding a city in whose midst both Jews and Gentiles dwell, and remember we use the term nochri, as opposed to what? Goy, because that only later gets the meaning of it being one person from another nation. Who's really the one person from another nation in Torah? The Nochri. Goy is really a term for people. Until the time that Goy is throughout Talmudic literature a little, but even more into the past Talmudic literature, Goy becomes, as we understand it today, one of the people from those peoples. Okay, so this is a place where both Jews and Gentiles dwell. V'haitava merchat ha-mirachetet b'shabbat, and whose public bathhouse operates on the Sabbath. 27. Maharam amends the Gemara to read, and whose bathhouse is heated up on the Sabbath. What's the difference? He is pointing out about the heating up, the water and the creation of the steam. And on the other hand, the Gemara might be talking about the fact that one would go to the bathhouse to bathe. two different kinds of Sabbath issues when it comes to those pieces about the bathhouse. Now, just to note again, what was ancient bathhouse culture like? Anybody ever been to the bathhouse on Masada?
Maybe. I don't remember.
Okay, maybe. It was more recently excavated and...
Is that the place where they have a lot of naked men sitting there?
Naked skeletons.
I don't think they had any plaque that said the Schwitz. So, no one with a broom. What's interesting is that...
It was elevated floor.
Yeah, so Ron's saying there's an elevated floor, and in our excavations, and this is why archaeology is just so brilliant in terms of helping us read texts. So the Journal of Jewish Folklore had a wonderful article about Jewish bathhouses in the 1st through 6th centuries. CE. And the practice that we had in the bathhouses from the 1st century to the 6th century are based on the fact that, according to the claims there, the bathhouses did not change for a couple hundred years before that. What was at stake? How to understand a midrash where Rabbi Yehuda was standing on one of the columns in the bathhouse. No one understood. What does it mean he's standing on one of the columns in the bathhouse? A floor in the bathhouse, inside the mikveh-like the bath, somewhere within the bathhouse that could be understood, the bench, maybe where everybody came in after they had gone through the bathing process. Well, the column must have indicated that part of the floor fell out. The floor in the steam chamber, where you could go and sit to steam, is indeed elevated on small columns, so like lolly columns, and then there's a floor, and underneath you would have very, very hot water that would send the steam rising up through what was most of the time limestone plastered walls, a little teeny window or another to let in some light. But as I understand it, even a small window can, if it's done like conically, can let in enough light so that the place could be lit up enough and not let so much of the steam out. And you had this bathhouse, and then we understood Rabbi Yehuda, because it could have been standing on one of these columns, because maybe it was one that was either abandoned, destroyed in a certain part, or a part of the floor fell through and they still tried to use it. Whatever it was, we now understand the Midrash, and now in terms of how to read a Talmudic text where it says, and they heated up water in the bathhouse, that what they meant is that there has to be a fire going and there has to be enough heat underneath based on the fires that were lit to have the next level of water kind of boil as if it was that kind of double boiler reality so that steam could be sent up through. And of course at the bath side, they would heat up the water over there and make the water hot for a bath in yet different ways, sometimes from underneath, sometimes from the side, and the waters would be hot. So these are interesting archaeological realities that help for the literacy we need to understand the realia of what's doing here.
One of the best preserved buildings in Pompeii is the bathhouse. And it's a very large building, a very luxurious building there with murals on the walls. And it has the floors described in many separate sections.
In Pompeii?
Yes.
Field trip, Gemara class. Okay. So here is the bathhouse that's operating. Jews and non-Jews live in the place. Im rov nochrin, if a majority of the people who use the bathhouse on a Saturday night are Gentiles, mutar lirchotz ba miyad, you can go on a Saturday night, post-Shabbat, and you can go and enjoy it. Why? Who did they heat the water for? Who did they make the steam for? For the Gentiles. So it's interesting that, you know who has this problem? restaurants that have a kashrut stamp of approval, a heksher, who are open on the Sabbath. Either they are officially owned by non-Jews. The food, though, and the preparation of the food is all kosher. And they make soup. And they serve great split pea soup, great miso soup, whatever you like. Question is, on a Saturday night, can I go? Can I eat the soup? If I'm concerned about who the customers are that need to be served that soup, for whom really it was made, I would have to guarantee myself along these lines that it really wasn't prepared for me. Wasn't prepared for the Jewish community. Despite the fact that the restaurant is kosher, it might be that the restaurant does so much business in a neighborhood that you could find in New York, or you could find in a densely populated Jewish area, and it could do enough business for the non-Jewish crowds that I might be able to eat even the soup that was boiled and heated up right then on the day. So it's an interesting application of the law. Okay, Iyam Rov Yisrael, but if the majority of people, the majority of users are Jewish people, Yamtin Bichade Sheyechamu Chamin, one has to wait a length of time sufficient that the water would heat up entirely after the Sabbath. So in the sense that all the water is heated up at the same time, even though some of the hot water added and contributed to the fact that the water could be heated up potentially a little faster, you're fine. So the Gemara answers the question. Hatam ki mecham mei. There, when the bathhouse attendants heat up the water, ad ata deruba mecham mei, they heat them with the majority in mind. That is, the act of Sabbath desecration is performed primarily for Jews, and so the hot waters are prohibited. However, in the case of a single Gentile and a single Jew, what do you do? What's the word? The Gentile performs the malacha primarily for himself, and so the Jew may benefit from the labors. Ah, so the Gemara wants to go back to this issue of, does someone, can I imagine that someone's doing this simply for himself, and that, what? Ner le'me'ah comes from ner le'achad. The candle for 100 simply came from the candle that he lit for himself. Ner le'achad, ner le'me'ah is the principle. He did it for himself, so he doesn't care if I enjoy the benefit. He wasn't thinking of me. He wasn't transgressing a Sabbath law, a major category of Sabbath work, on my behalf. And again, I'm concerned that I shouldn't be over. Okay.
Can I ask you, why is this, according to the... Why does it say the answers of both Abaye and Rava are challenged? What is it about what we just learned that's a challenge? Aren't
they just reaffirming it ultimately? Or is it, what is it even about the Mishnah that suggests that that's a different view? Well, Rava's answer before had the approach, up above, we were talking about the Rabban Gamliel's disembarking. Rava says that Rabban Gamliel said that he made the gangplank outside of our presence, so let's use it. In other words, what? I didn't catch eyes like this. You know? I didn't say to him, make the gangplank for me. As quippy as that is, that might be what they're thinking. Like, if I'm in your presence, and if I'm in his presence, and he sees me, and he says, oh, I got to put the gangplank down. I mean, people are wonderfully generous in that way, a lot of times. You know, I'll give you the for instance, because we're going to get back to these issues even after we do a little bit more inside here and look at Abaye as well. But this is Rava. I walk into my building, and people know me and know that I'm Sabbath observant, right? I think I've mentioned to you all the trainings. It's really been wonderful, by the way, how much they want to learn and how much they do for us. But, let's say that I walk into the building after he opens the door for me, which we've, you know, in essence agreed on, and that's going to be the whole issue of Amira Benochri. What can I really say to that non-Jewish soul in my neighborhood, and how can he fulfill certain generosities to me that would seem as though I was doing Sabbath work? But what if there's one more step that I would not have done? Like, for sure, he could see it's raining, and he could run out with that big umbrella that he's got, and he could walk me down the street. Certainly, I can't use the umbrella. But I didn't ask him to do it. He threw it up on top of my head. Right? Because he saw me, and he might have thought, oh, I got the sense that Rabbi wants me to do anything I can to help make his Sabbath a little bit nicer, and in the last leg here, rain's coming down, I'm gonna walk him in with the umbrella. What if he put a canopy up, though, over the spot between the scaffolding and my little awning at my building? And it's one of these, like, little umbrella-looking, you know, you fold it out, and on each side now there's a little bit more dry space, because sometimes on those days, when it comes to letting people into our building, they try to make a little bit more of an awning, because our awning is like one of these little, like this.
So you're saying he hasn't done it for you?
Right! And I wasn't there. And Rava's point is, I wasn't there. He didn't come running to do it for me. And somebody says to me, should we walk around it? And I say to him, we don't need to walk around it. I wasn't there when he put it up. That's Rava's claim here. That Rabban Gamliel was justifying walking down the gangplank because he wasn't around. He was not in cahoots. He didn't upend the law.
With the umbrella, isn't that who... This is your doorman? Isn't that his job to come out with the umbrella, whoever's walking in? Not just you.
Yeah, but I can't create a tent over my head.
But he's just doing his job. In other words, he would go out there with anyone.
But he saw me.
Yeah.
And Rava's point is that if he saw me, I'm now working with Rava. There's other reasons why we can't do it. But for Rava's system, it's kind of like we made a pact at that moment that I needed to be drier because I was kind of running to get into the building. Really, I wouldn't do it, therefore I wouldn't ask him.
How is that different from his pushing the button for on the elevator?
That, because I already had an Amira, and we're going to get to that today. I already had set up with him certain kinds of understandings of what it means to come in a Sabbath observant way into my building. And there is a fundamental difference between what I set up in the conversation I have and how I say it to what I need done. And plus, the whole umbrella issue, of course, gets back to a very, very big discussion in halacha itself, and that is, it's not halachically permissible for me to use an umbrella.
So if you've told him in advance and instructed him when you see me on the Sabbath, isn't he in effect acting as your agent?
We're going to get to that today, inside the text, so I don't want to answer just right now.
Can you put a book over your head to see the rain, or
you can't wear a hat?
Wear a hat, but you can't put anything over your head. Bring your hand.
By the way, the book, the law about the book, if you want to balance the book, someone might say, hey, you have a head covering, right? But we shouldn't do it for the fact that in halacha, there are rules about books and getting them wet.
I'm not talking about prayer books.
Any wisdom, I would put it to that category. Now, that's me, including a comics book.
Or a newspaper for that.
Right.
If he comes out with an umbrella and you refuse to go under it, then you hurt his feelings, which must be against the rules.
No, not really.
Not really.
See, this is the thing. We don't want to malbin pene chave roba rabin. You're right. We don't want to turn somebody's face white in public, and that's our expression, you know, regardless of race, skin, creed, color. We say that drawing the blood out of someone's face and embarrassing them is terrible. You're right, right? However, it's very important to note the following when it comes to that principle. And any ethical principle like that. At a certain point, one has to come up with the adult ability to communicate to those around you in order to keep and guard the Sabbath laws. So I could hurt somebody's feeling if I'm not going to eat kosher by them. But my responsibility is to be able to communicate in a way that says, I have taken upon myself the mitzvah of kashrut, and I really need to ask you to understand this is because I am keeping kosher to the best of my ability. Same with Shabbat. So that the hope of the sources, when it comes to that very issue, is to be able to say, you could be as much a mensch as possible, and even go back and apologize if you need to, if you were to offend, but that not to break the Sabbath. That even goes to your parents. And that's why in Parashat Kedoshim, the mitzvah of fearing your mother and father, where it puts mother before the fathers, because we usually fear the father, and Rashi talks about that piece, it says, and right, ish imo v'aviv tirao ve'et shabbatotai tishmoru. Very good. See, that's when you have a bar mitzvah parasha, you remember. You really remember. Shkoyach. So you have the juxtaposition of fearing your mother and father, or having some kind of deep respect that goes beyond just simply kavod, like respect. You have a certain sense that they are godly in their nature, because where else do we have yirah but with yirat Hashem, with godliness. But the second half of the verse is et shabbatai tishmaru. You shall keep my Sabbath. And so the midrash halacha there, the legal explication of the verse says, even if your parents tell you to break the Sabbath, one must refrain from doing so and keep it. Super commentary. I can't embarrass my parents in public. Says so in Kedushin. One of the things that it explains to me is that if I want to challenge my father in Jewish law, I go and I say in private, didn't you mean this? Didn't you mean that? I shouldn't do it in public. Right? However, when it comes to Sabbath observance, I have to then go ask for forgiveness if I have to say to my parents, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I can't light that lamp that you just asked me to light. Is it because he or she was ill that they needed my help? Maybe I could put it in that framework and actually respect my mother. But now I'm playing mental jumping jacks, right? I know for a certain amount of approach to creating Sabbath reality, there will be certain things that somebody who's not necessarily observing Sabbath might ask me to do that I ought to find a way to say, I really can't do that, even if it's your parents. Says the extensive commentary on that verse and then the Sabbath laws. So with a Jew and a non-Jew on the Sabbath, it's true we have to be very careful how we say, what we say, and how we set up the scenario. And that's why Jewish law went through and tried to help us define what we say and how we say it. That is part of the packet that I gave you, which I want to turn to now. If you turn to this is the packet. I think, does now everybody at least have one or one right next to them to share? Here's one more set of sources. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you got it. Good. Okay. So I want to go outside the page of Gemara here. And I want to share with you, I want to, B'Shem Omro, in the name of the person who I learned this from, and to recognize that most of the sources were collected by him for a shiur in this matter, for a class in this matter. So this is Rabbi Benny Krohn, who gave this shiur, and the source sheets here include various sources regarding the Shabbos Goy. Does it really exist? Guidelines for what? Maybe you've heard the term Shabbos Goy. Guidelines for Amira Lin Nochri on Shabbat. It's the page that says it's got boxes on it. Turn four pages in to the packet. What page was that? Yeah, five. Sorry, I gave that away. You have page five? Yeah, okay, good. Okay. No, I have one that I have marked up. Okay, so what we have is a source from page 150, side A, as the first source. The Mishnah there says, Lo yiskor adam po'alim b'Shabbat. Person should not hire workers on Shabbat. V'lo yomar adam l'chaveiro liskor lo po'alim. And you shouldn't say to somebody else, go hire me some workers.
On Shabbat.
On Shabbat. So, just using that part of the Mishnah, which is the part that we're going to be concerned about with this issue of what we say to non-Jews. First of all, it says, you yourself can't hire workers. Secondly, it says, to whom in this Mishnah? L'chaveiro. Who would you think that is?
Agent.
We talked about it already. We learned it once through. An agent. What were the two possibilities we talked about? Chaveiro. One.
That you did it before.
Before or during. But we've said here, b'Shabbat. We said that chaveiro could either be a Jew, his friend who was Jewish, or we said chaveiro might not be a Jew. Okay? So the Gemara says the following. Maishna hu, umaishna chaveiro. What does it mean that it taught him and his friend? Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa holds the following. Chaver nochri. We're talking about a neighbor or chaver, and again, using the word chaver, not just nochri. Chaver nochri. Makif la Rav Ashi, but we have a challenge from Rav Ashi. Amira l'nochri shvut. Wait a minute. I have a problem, perhaps. Because I might be transgressing something here. A rabbinic level of shvut. What's the root of shvut? Shabbat. I might be transgressing a rabbinic prohibition to make sure that Shvut happens within my realm. I have to not hire anyone. So, what's that?
Isn't that what it said? You can't hire anybody and you cannot ask somebody.
That's what it said, and you can't ask anybody. Rashi says, Lo yaseh behem. Why do we have to concern ourselves with what Rashi says? Because he is going to make a comment on a verse from the Torah regarding Sabbath work. We're in Perek Yudbet in chapter 12, and we need to open the Torah.
Where's the Tanakh when you need it?
On this wall.
No,
they need to
put it. Yeah, very good.
So we're going to go to chapter 12. Hold on one moment. That's right. I didn't get the verse in the parak. Interesting. Are you going through the parak?
16. Oh, yes, Sabbath. But it's not about Shabbat.
Right. Okay, so Uvayom HaRishon Mikra Kodesh. You shall celebrate a sacred occasion on the first day, and a sacred occasion on the seventh day. No work at all shall be done on them, only what every person is to eat, that alone may be prepared for you. And we're talking about the Pesach celebration. Thank you. And in this case, afilu al yedei acherim, Rashi says about the Pesach matter, the Gemara, or in this case the Mechilta, another midrashic. Even at the hands of others, no work shall be done. So what happens here is that the Mechilta says, I'm going to make this about all festivals and all Sabbaths. And when it comes to the notion of how we celebrate and how we keep our festivals and how we keep our Sabbaths, no work's going to be done by me, and no work's going to be done by others. And that is a possibility that the Midrashic commentary puts out on the way we understand malacha, the way we understand a major category of work within our tradition. And perhaps since it's a major category of legal approaches to work done in our, wherever we are, residences, settlements, where we find ourselves for any given Sabbath, our tachum as it develops over time, because remember, we don't really know where the first halachic kind of definition of tachum comes from. But what I'm saying is, in terms of the development of it as a halachic category that we abide by in terms of our Sabbath observance, we're not sure exactly when does that start. Who's the first person to institute that you only have four amot unless you make an eruv out there with a certain food item, and then it's 2,000, and then you could extend that another 2,000 and make that 4,000 all in all. That perhaps the Torah, according to Rashi, which he's quoting the Mechilta, this Midrash commentary, is saying that no work should be done by you or by anybody else. Yeah.
The Mishnah does not refer to work on Shabbat. It refers to hiring workers on Shabbat.
Right. So
in the Mishnah, this, I don't know the implication might be, well, if you hire them before Shabbat to do some work for you, that would be different than hiring them on Shabbat. It doesn't say specifically.
No. Good. So keep that in mind. Is hiring somebody before Shabbat to do work for you on Shabbat going to be different than hiring somebody through somebody else on the Sabbath? Does it seem like it would be?
Hiring somebody
before Shabbat?
But he's confused. The second level.
I'm thinking, to be perfectly honest, kind of practically, let's say the Yom Tov, because the Pasuk here refers to a Yom Tov.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a housekeeper, she works for you a few years, she lives in the house, and it is your custom when you go to shul and you have to come home, the table is set and you're being served your lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
With this mishnah, you could ask, is that all right?
Correct.
I know the answer, maybe, but it's not,
it better be.
Right, so this Mishnah could be theoretically saying, if you see that that's a Yizkor Adam Poalim B'Shabbat, that even if you made it before Shabbat, that would be problematic. But if the Mishnah is saying we're talking about the actual hire on the Sabbath, that's more in line with what we're thinking about in terms of this Mishnah.
But the word Jesus described isn't forbidden on Shabbat. Setting the table isn't forbidden on Shabbat, so having somebody else do it is
working for pay.
Right. So, that's what I heard. With this whole issue of working for pay in my residence. So the Mishnah is saying particularly on Shabbat, you can't say to them, come and be a second person in my house right now. Friday night happened already. You think you need another person. You're not going out to do that. The question is whether or not, by way of the Havero, you can't say, or you can say, come and work for me. According to this Mishnah, v'lo yomar adam l'chaver ol yizkor lo poalim. We say to the chaver that you can't do this either on my behalf. Okay, and then the question is, who's this chaver? So, let's push through a little bit more and see how multivalenced it is. What's going to happen is that The rabbis are going to argue about whether or not you have the ability via shaliach to go out and hire somebody. Can you appoint an agent to do something that you yourself wouldn't do about this issue of hiring somebody? But then they're going to get into the question of, but what of the things that I want done that I could say to someone and have done if I'm only talking about the issue of hiring versus anything else?
Well,
that I might need to have done within my residence. So even if you tell me that hiring is not allowable by the non-Jew on my behalf, because at the end of the day, really the hiring comes back to me. I'm responsible for paying that person. I'm the one who is gaining from that employment. Versus, let's say, at this moment, having someone help me open the door to my building, where even though it seems like it's for me at this moment, since I made the arrangement, and it was done because the arrangement was made previous to the Sabbath, and I, yes, benefited directly, but didn't have any further obligation to someone in my employ. I didn't create a contract for the sake of employment. Is it different? So someone might argue on the face of it, well, it's the same. You're gaining a benefit by having an employee, and you're also gaining the benefit by having the door open for you, right? But on the other hand, what happens if I don't get the door open? Versus my making the hire on a Sunday. I have to at some point understand what needs to be done, letzorech Shabbat, for the needs I have on the Sabbath. And part of what is being weighed within the discussions of these sources is, what do I really need now? How do I accomplish that with the relationship I have with this non-Jew on the Sabbath? And how do I avoid any kind of prohibition in a larger sense that I don't either need now or that I ought not to transgress? And this gets back into that question of how many of these can I keep track of, and what do I need to actually think at any given moment of saying anything, and is there a way that I can train myself to actually speak the words I need to in the way I need to in order to accomplish what I'm seeking to vis-a-vis the non-Jewish person's help at this moment in my Sabbath observance.
So going back to the umbrella, if it's just sprinkling, right, you can be a little damp, but if it's a cold, windy day, and it's a torrential downpour, and you're going to be stuck in a dripping wet suit in a cold shul or in a cold house, then maybe it is okay for the doorman to come running with an umbrella for you.
Right. I mean, you could do some. You could do some reasoning.
It's okay. He's on his way home. He can change when he gets up.
I see.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the bottom line is that, for that matter, there would be the isur of establishing this tent over myself that I would want to avoid, especially if it was somehow looking like I was asking for it to happen. Again, like the comment, isn't that his job, and shouldn't he be able to run out and do that for you? One might say it's the same as him having established that small kind of, I don't even know what you call these awning. Things. They're not tents, and canopy. They're not really awnings, because they don't stick off. Maybe the canopy. They have these pop-up beach kind of canopies. Yeah. Sun canopies, perhaps. It's a sukkah. Love you. So, all right, let's see a little bit more inside. Because one approach is to say that I refrain from any of this at all. And that the Mishnah was saying, even a non-Jew, I shouldn't say anything to. Because there's a law within Torah, when it comes to Yontif and it comes to Shabbos, that we should just refrain from it. But there's another approach. And that is, found in a comment in terms of just to explain it, that Rashi again makes, and that is with what Yeshayahu the prophet says in chapter 58 about the Sabbath, and that is, he says, don't talk about business on the Sabbath. Take your feet out of the marketplace. Don't allow yourself to do any kind of business or give and take of business. And daber davar. Don't speak a particular speech. Meaning what in a certain way? Don't say exactly what you need done in terms of the work that you're looking for. That's what it really meant. In terms of not transgressing any of the Sabbath laws, don't explicitly go over to someone and say, on the Sabbath, right now I want you to open the door for me because I can't do it. It's my Shabbat. So the law comes in terms of the performance of Sabbath law to take a little bit of that sensibility and say, but then how can we speak to the non-Jews around us and fulfill some of these needs that we have? And that is the area of law called Amira L'Nochri. What we say to a non-Jew in regards to Shabbat, which later becomes known as Shabbos Goy. There are many people who feel that that term is pejorative. There are many people. Well, sometimes to the Goy who served in that capacity.
Isn't even Goy pejorative at this stage?
And isn't it? However, there have been those who have put it on their resume.
Goy?
Absolutely.
Where? Applying for a job in a Jewish institution.
So I recall hearing...
That's an old joke about
I recall hearing several people who lived in Jewish neighborhoods really take pride in the fact that I was in their house and I was their Shabbos Goy.
Actually, why not? It's not the...
And said with a certain sense of appreciation for the relationship that could happen to help make a Sabbath culture and environment really work. It has been presented in such a positive light.
Maybe they're in union at this
point. You probably know this. Elvis Presley was a Shabbos
Goy. I did not know about
it. He wrote about it.
I did not know about Elvis. I heard Cory Booker often talk one time. He was presenting at a talk that he gave with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. And he was talking about time at Oxford. Right. And Colin Powell, well, let's not draw an inference. Right. Anyway, Cory Booker said when I visited and I got friendly with Rabbi Shmuley, I would often go and I would be in the house and we'd, you know, have a l'chaim and something needed to be done. And Rabbi Shmuley would say, boy, is it hot in here. And he would help create the environment that was right by, you know, changing the thermostat or doing something that would help create the right environment for the Sabbath. That extends from a whole corpus of law concerning Amira L'Nochri, the way we say things to the non-Jews who were in our orbit, who enjoyed the Sabbath as a cultural reality. And you see here in Mishnah Brura on the bottom of the page, where underneath where it says appropriate way to hint to a non-Jew to perform a malacha.
You don't have this in English, do you?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. I'm reading and translating. I just want to read to you a couple of the quotes. Or let me start from the beginning. Achi l'amar she'asor lo mar lo b'shabbat. It's forbidden for him to say on Shabbat. To say to him on Shabbat, Eze devar sheyavim mitoch kach sheyaseh malacha. It's forbidden for you to say a direct statement that would lead a non-Jewish person to do one of the major categories of forbidden work on the Sabbath. So I can't say to somebody, go and boil that pot of water. Even if I was using the pot of water for heat, let's say, in one of the old apartments that had not, you know, no great heat. I'm using an example. But what might I say, just so that I'll hint you into the end of the Mishnah?
It's very cold in
Boy,
here.
Is it cold in here. Okay, now Sur Lamar Le'eno Yehudi, and it's also forbidden to say to a person who's not a Jew, She Itnachot Mok Desi Yavin She Yasira Pham Shibarosh Haner Achishel Mer Harimiza Le'eno Yehudi Shalob L'Shon Tzivui. And it's also kind of forbidden to say exactly what? Right, so what do you think that is on a candle? Usually it's a coal, right?
Yeah.
So in this case, it's on a candle.
Yeah.
It's like, the black part?
On the wick.
So take out the black parts on the wick and any of the material that wasn't burning exactly right. Candles weren't perfect sometimes. And you had to kind of clean out the area there to have them burn nicely again. Right? That is forbidden. But to say something that's not in command form, Sheomer Haner Eino Meir Yafe. Oh, this candle's not burning so brightly. Oh, Eino Yachol Likrot Laor Haner Hazeh Sheyesh Bo Pacham. I can't really read by the light of this candle that has this blackened part that look, like a little bit of what seemed like now a coal and ashes on top. Can you please? V'shomea ha'eno yudi, and the non-Jew hears it, mitakno, and he fixes it, shari. That's permissible. The ein ze bichlal amira. That is in no way, shape, or form the amira, the way of saying something that is forbidden under the category that we kind of established from Isaiah the prophet. Someone once asked me, do we establish halakha by way of the prophets? This is the way of establishing halakha by way of what the prophet said, without it being codific. We sense that we were able to come up with a way of saying something to this Eino Yehudi, to this non-Jew, through the understanding that we shouldn't say daber davar, we shouldn't say things directly, and the codes then take it and codify it later on, 11th century, 12th century, 14th century, 16th century, and here we have the exact way to hint to the non-Jew.
You say that you can do it so the Nosli can enjoy the same culture as us, the Jews, because he's with us.
Sometimes, unless the person's hired, and that's a whole different story.
Usually, those Nosli's, if we are in the room that is heated, is usually in the room that is not heated. And we call him to fix it.
Oh, that's not the case here.
Yeah, but that's the case in real life.
Not really, I would say. I mean, I spent many, many Shabbos in homes in L.A., where you had non-Jewish workers in the homes who had, frankly, beautiful space. They were not included in every meal. They didn't sit down with the families.
And they didn't sit down and read together to the same table.
Well, some of them, some of the folks who were in the orbit did in a way, they were part of family life. They were respected for who they were. You can have a modern Jewish situation where that would happen. Sometimes in a community, to earn a few kopecks, you had someone who was willing to kind of go and see what was needed here and there. They didn't expect to hang out. That's part of the history that we have about what this institution of Shabbos Goy is about. It's not as though we had great power over people
to live in a room over there.
It's just a deal, you know. It's not a great power. It's just what agreement you made with them.
Right. It is about the agreement. But...
So it's not about the culture.
But obviously there are values that should inform the way we do these things. If they had not informed these practices, if that's the point that you're making, that we ought to think about these things more carefully. That's why this shiur, why this class was done, actually, for an Orthodox shul in Teaneck.
Yeah, but one of the wonderful things about Mishneh Berurah is that, although it's not written just in the past few years, it's very contemporary. So the discussion about the way things are to be done is much closer to the way we do things now than it was 2,000 years ago. And there are cases where people who work for families are very integrated into the life of the family. I mean, even when our kids were little and we had babysitters, baby did sit with us and eat meals. He was always in the room with us. And the air conditioning had to go on. We weren't the only ones who benefited from it. No, she didn't work on Shabbat, but had she been there on a weekend day or something, she was completely part of our family. She hasn't worked for us 10 years. He's still never over and still taught her, and she's still part of our life. So not all these situations, this big wealthy family, but these poor servants who are living out in the dirt, and they are part of the family. I'm too ready for this.
Show me how many family.
Yeah, I don't have a count.
So it seems to me, though, there are indirect, nice ways to say almost anything on Shabbat that would accomplish what you need, including, you know, with such a hot day, I bet my flock must be thirsty. I mean, there's nothing that you can't say indirectly that would clue somebody in. No?
In this case, I would just go back to our Mishnah, right? Much of it is in the mindset.
Because it becomes coded language, in effect. In other words, it's one thing for one time you say, boy, it's hot here. But when it becomes clear that boy, it's hot here, you just turn the air conditioner on. But you're right. But the point is, we do it differently because we're cognizant of the fact
that
it's
about... Well, that's nice. No, I like that. But all I'm saying is, actually, there is something lovely about it because it could carry over, you know, to the life of...
Right. Right.
No, and there's also something incredibly manipulative about this to have this as everyday behavior. And many of us know people,
right?
This is the only way that they go and exist, and they get everyone else to do their work.
That's a different issue. You're not talking about Shabbat now.
No, but
life.
I mean, it's bad that it's in the text. Since we all know people...
That's the Musar issue. Right.
The Musar issue.
That is the ethical issue that might arise out
right,
of it
right.
if one is to take this
really,
way
right.
of saying
right.
on Shabbat and right. live life with it. I want to just go back, though, to the halachic principle that we've now established and read our Mishnah again with that in mind. Because the way I read a Mishnah depends on which principle I'm applying and which principle I'm trying to seek to understand within the scenario, right? So before, I was reading Ner Le Echad Ner Le Mea. I was saying that if a non-Jew lit one candle, I could benefit from it because there's enough light, right? Rava, getting back to Dan's question, because you thought that I didn't address Abaye before, but I want to make sure that we go back now and understand where he was before we now apply our new principle. Abaye and Rava had a discussion about Rabban Gamliel's situation. Remember the gangplank again? So, Rava said he wasn't present, remember? And therefore he could benefit. Abaye had said... No, Rabban Gamliel was not in the Gentile's presence when the latter made the gangplank, hence the Gentile had no intent to benefit from him. Rava Amar, even if you say that Rabban Gamliel was in the Gentile's presence when the gangplank was constructed, its use would still be permitted on the grounds that Ner Le'echad Ner Le'mea. So Rava was the one to apply that principle, and it was really that Rabban Gamliel agreed with Abaye. So I want to go back and just make that tikkun, make that fix on the sugya. I was holding up before Rava as the one who said he wasn't in his presence. But Rava was the one who said even if he was in the presence, Abaye was the one to apply the Ner Le'echad Ner Le'mea principle. So you'll forgive me that Abaye is the one to say, I have the principle to read the Mishnah. Rabban Gamliel disembarked because if it was going to be used for one person, it could be used for 100 people. Rava said even if Rabban Gamliel was in the Gentiles' presence when the gangplank was considered, it could still be permitted. And that meaning that I could hint this person into my need. Okay? So, the Gemara that came to challenge both of those was all about whether or not the majority of non-Jews would benefit versus the Jewish people. That if anything is being done here, the only way that somebody could open the door for Rabbi Bolton coming into his building would be that if there's a whole family of 12, so that my 6 could walk in. Right? That's the Gemara's challenge to either of them, that it has to be a majority rule. I'm not going to apply the principle, if it's good for one and it was a non-Jew, then it could be good for 100. And I'm not going to apply the principle that he was there to hint this guy into the fact that he wanted to get off. Because even if he was, who would have been okay? Rava would have been okay with that. Now we have a new principle by which to understand the Mishnah, and that is the Daber Davar. That is the principle that I really can't say, go do this specific malacha for me. Go do this specific Shabbat forbidden labor on my behalf. How do I read the Mishnah like that? Rabban Gamliel says, what does he say? They were there, Rabban Gamliel and Zakeni, Shehayu Ba'im Bespina, they came in and landed on a ship, Va'asa Nochri Kevis Leredbo, and a gangplank is put down, and Va'yerdu Bo Rabban Gamliel Uzakeni, and they go down, and they walk off the ship. Has Rabban Gamliel said anything in our case, according to a very close reading of the Mishnah?
No.
Has he even hinted?
No.
What if his presence is the hint?
They know he wants to go home from
Rav. Who's okay with that? Rava. Who's not okay with that? Abaye. What principle did Abaye apply to why it's okay? He doesn't really have... What's that? He's not okay. He's like this. Abaye says it like this. Rabban Gamliel must not have been in the Gentile's presence when the latter made the gangplank. Hence, the Gentile had no intent to benefit him. So Abaye says he wasn't there. So in other words, when my guy put up the canopy and had no intention to benefit me, what now? I could walk under it. The Gemara comes and says, sorry, it's not that he wasn't there when you created this gangplank, back in our Gemara. And it's not that it's ner lechad ner lemeah. It's not that it was just done for one person so that everybody on the ship can now walk on it. It was because there was a majority of non-Jews on the ship, and they got off. However, reading now with our new principle that is expanded in the codes, can I understand Rabban Gamliel did not say to transgress a particular malacha? I can say that Rabban Gamliel did not ask any non-Jew. And I can't even see that he hinted if I read only with the Mishnah. Therefore, I am considering what? His presence as being what? A hint, and done Daber Davar correctly. In other words, he's hinting versus saying anything specific. And thusly, the permission for me to hint, even with my presence, that someone should know by my presence that something needs to happen in order to make
me able to continue observing the Sabbath, that is also a form of Amira L'Nochri. And that I wouldn't be guilty by showing myself in that place where something could be done for me in order to get me where I need to go. Now, is an elevator a gangplank? I don't know, but listen to how it works too. Sometimes I'll have someone who comes, stops by, says good Shabbos. I enjoy that on a Shabbos afternoon for a round. And I walk them downstairs. Someone should walk with someone, you know, almost out of the building and even out of the building. I'll walk back in, and what? I'll stand at the desk. If I'm too lazy to take the stairs. And what do they look? They look at me at this point and they say,
oh, the rabbi's tired.
I don't need to say a word.
No, you can sound so tired.
And they're going. I could say, oh, I'm so tired.
Yeah.
I love the marble floor in the elevator.
It's such a smooth
and
ride.
And so then they get the elevator.
And then they get the elevator. But if I was to say, could you press the button for me?
That's
not an Amira L'Nochri. That's valid.
But what about the Shabbos elevator?
Now, the Shabbos elevator would be nice in a building that had enough Jewish people to justify a Shabbos elevator. But they don't set up a Shabbos elevator. When I was in Chicago, Amy's parents live on the 29th floor. So, I see Daryl. I say, Daryl, how are you? Scott, new to the family? Can we talk? It's Friday. I come in post services Friday night, and he's got it. Saturday morning.
Yeah, that's a problem. You're gonna get
down.
No Daryl. My thighs were throbbing. I come back and Daryl wasn't on. Daryl took it upon himself to tell the next guy on duty all about the scenario. Guy walked up to me and said, finally I understand now why we do this for these six other families in the building who say to me always, could you press whatever? Because we don't do that. That's not part of our job.
Then you said they're not supposed to
ask. I said, wait a minute.
Now I'm walking up.
Wait a minute.
I cannot say I'm walking up, no.
I said, wait a minute. I didn't ask you to press any buttons for me. My mistake.
And he said, now you're really pressing my buttons.
So I walked up. Sometimes not saying anything. Here's the nafkamina. Sometimes not saying anything. This is the challenge.
Okay, but what would have been the solution on Saturday morning to get the elevator to take you down? You could just stand there and hope and pray a neighbor came out?
You could.
It might be one of the...
No, 29. No, understand.
You did so
26.
So we haven't got there, but I mean, is the sideways hinting something that you do on Shabbos or before Shabbos? Can you be explicit?
Okay, so let's ask. Yeah, with only a couple minutes left.
I just have one quick question. Could you have asked Daryl to tell someone at 8:30 in the morning to send the elevator up to 23 and let it open?
So that's the same question. What if I set things up before Shabbat? Okay. So there's a body of halachic literature that deals with how I set this into motion. And the discussions from the get-go are about setting into motion that which you will need or that which you must have in order to keep the Sabbath and to call it a delight. So the fact that you keep the Sabbath and call it a delight allows for a lot of room in what I set up. So in a household, the question is asked of like a rabbi, the rabbis out in California at the time, I remember I went to an afternoon class. Do you allow for those people working in your home to load all of the dishes into the dishwasher?
You know, it's one thing to clear the table, it's another thing to... So the answer is, if you set this into motion beforehand and someone understands the needs of the house and that it can bring noi Shabbat, a beauty of Shabbat, to the atmosphere, to not have this mess, then you have no problem if you contract it before. But because the Mishnah says, the first one we read, lo yiskor adam po'alim b'Shabbat, you can't do it, and you can't even sometimes hint at what you would pay this person consistently for over the weeks. So the idea is this, that if I'm going to consistently hire you for work, I put that into motion into perpetuity. If I have something that right now is making a difference, though, like this person does know to turn on and off lights in a house, but I can't read, so the amirah becomes the important part of what I have to do. Now I have to say it in the right way. Boy, I'm having a hard time reading in here. And the person has to be clued in to how to fix something. As manipulative as it sounds, it's trying to create a scenario, in my estimation. And this book talks a lot about this. And this is called The Shabbos Goy by Professor Yaakov Katz, by Jacob Katz. And this entire book is written as a study in this entire area of halakhic literature and the way we have had this institution, both through the sources and culturally. The idea is that one would set into motion agreements with people who understood the kind of Shabbat atmosphere and the kind of Shabbat reality that we wanted to achieve, but that we did not abuse that. And we did not make little of the law by going so far as to commit transgressions and doing malachot that we otherwise do not need perform for us on Shabbat. And that was the worry. How far would this institution go? Rabbi Dr. Katz says the following. The expression Sabbath Gentile apparently derived from the Yiddish phrase Shabbos Goy, and it has in the Hebrew tongue a derogatory connotation implying criticism of the Jewish religious tradition for rendering Jews dependent on the assistance of non-Jews in their religious observance. This criticism results from an aspiration to absolute national independence, an aspiration that has on occasion led to conflicts with traditional patterns of living. Yet during the period that Jewish tradition reigned supreme, this dependence caused no signs of embarrassment whatsoever. Halakhic sources recommend the use of the Gentile services with little hesitation, provided the service is permissible according to the rules of halakha. Such permission, however, depended upon the fulfillment of numerous conditions. The problem halakhic experts confronted was how to define the boundaries of the permitted and the prohibited, and how to ensure that the Jewish public would indeed remain within the realm of the permitted and not stray into that which is forbidden. So this is exactly the case of knowing that we had to make these contractual arrangements, that we had to have a way of speaking so that it was not daber davar, it was not making a shaliach, an agent of someone to actually transgress one of the forbidden categories of law or otherwise Jewish laws that we wouldn't want to have broken on the Sabbath. And that when it did come to the agreements we had, we could always revise, be in contact, and as Professor Katz said here, it was not a cause of embarrassment, it was a cause to be within the mode of Shabbat culture. How that ultimately develops is worth reading about. I definitely recommend this book as a great study. Jacob Katz is one of the greatest halachists of all time and is well known for tracing the humanity, the sociology, and the reality of the Jewish law in all of its dynamism in his studies.
Should we do it tomorrow morning?
I'd like to have a question.
Tomorrow morning.